Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled Immigration Law Firms Maximizing Efficiency. I'm Becca Miller, AILA's Education Assistant, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Reed Trouts, the AILA Director of the Practice and Professionalism Center from Washington, D.C. Joining Reed is Angelo Paparelli from Los Angeles, California, and Davis Bay from Seattle, Washington. The speakers have selected some written materials for this podcast, which can be found in your AILA Agora Digital Library. Go to agora.aila.org and make sure you're signed in. On the top right of the page, you'll see a green button that says My Digital Library. Once on the page for your digital library, you'll see two files. One is the audio file, and right above or below, a resources file. If you have any questions, you can email agora@aila.org. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Reed.
Thank you, and welcome to everyone to the podcast on immigration law firms maximizing efficiency. My name is Reed Trouts. I'm the discussion leader. I'm on staff at AILA to help members with the business of practicing law, and I've been doing so for about 10 years, and we have a lot of resources on AILA.org to help members in the practice of law. So I'm really excited about today's podcast because this is a great topic to get into. And to help us with that today, we have Davis Bay and Angelo Paparelli. Davis is the regional managing partner of Fisher & Phillips. He's based in the Seattle office. His practice focuses on providing effective immigration solutions for companies in the Pacific Northwest and throughout the United States. He's a frequent speaker before business and employer groups, including AILA. He and I have done a number of articles and presentations over the years. Really glad to have Davis on the panel today. Also with us, Angelo Paparelli is a partner in the Business Immigration Practice Group of Safe Earth Shaw LLP, where he heads the firm's EB-5 Immigrant Investment Specialty Team in the offices from Los Angeles and New York. Angelo has been a well-known practitioner for many years, not only on the substantive issues, but in practice management as well, and has done programs both for AILA and others around the country, and has written quite substantially on the practice of immigration law as well. The interesting thing about both these gentlemen, even though they're with larger firms now, they have both been in practice and had their own practice. First, Davis with the Bay Law Group for 14 years, and Angelo had Paparelli and Partners for about 10 years. So they're very experienced in firms of all sizes in how to, you know, maximize efficiencies in those firms. So, gentlemen, thank you for being here today. Let's talk real quickly. Why this podcast today? We didn't suggest this topic, but AILA Education and the distance learning folks did, and they said this is an important topic. From your perspective, gentlemen, why do you think they chose this topic on maximizing efficiency today?
I'll jump in, Reed. This is Angelo. First of all, thank you for having me. I find this a fascinating subject. I believe that we lawyers who tend to take insufficient note of the business of law and are enthralled with the practice of law put ourselves, our families, our clients, our employees and coworkers and partners at risk. It's great to be the theoretician, the scholar, but if we're not the business person at the same time, we won't have an enterprise to support ourselves. And I think that's why they did it.
Yeah, I would add to what Angela is saying is that immigration law back when I started 23 years ago was a lot easier with the demands of clients, with the competition, and the technology that's out there, potential for outsourcing what we do, the breakdown of immigration practice in certain parts of the country to be not done by lawyers but by other kinds of resources, really requires us to make sure that we're smart about how we run our businesses and not just keeping up with the ever-changing complex landscape of immigration law. So managing the business, understanding how to not only have an efficient but an effective business really comes down to having tools and education that a lot of lawyers miss out on.
And I'll just add that we are completing and about to publish the 2016 AILA Marketplace Study that looks at the economics of law practice, and that should be out shortly after this podcast is published. But what the data is showing us is that while for many lawyers, including solos and small firms, while revenue has increased, their expenses have increased at probably a faster rate, so that profitability in many firms is not growing, and it's harder to do. And so I think that efficiency, this comes at a good time, because if you can build in efficiency into your practice, if you can be more productive with the resources that you have, if you can take less time to do things, that's going to increase your profitability or increase the bottom line without increasing your costs. And so I just think this is something that, and not just immigration lawyers, I talk to other lawyers across the country, it's happening there too. So finding those tools, finding the ways to become more efficient in the practice is really, I think, a trend that's going to be with us for a while longer. So we want to talk a little bit about today about business processes, systems and procedures, and then creating and reviewing metrics, right? How do you measure whether we're doing well? You don't always just look at the money at the bottom line. You look at other measurements to say, are we being as productive? And when we started preparing for this podcast, it turns out that all of us have really read the same book or come from the same background in terms of why it's important that we have systems and processes in firms to help us be more efficient. And that comes from the book The E-Myth, or The E-Myth Revisited, and quite frankly, there's even another book now called The E-Myth Attorney. And we've all subscribed to that and wanted to start out with that really today as to why that's important. So, gentlemen, when did you read that book, and what did you get out of that in terms of how that helps you organize your practice today?
Well, I think I read that book, about 15 years ago, and then since then have added books like Good to Great and Made to Stick and some other just great business guidance. It's important to make sure that everyone understands that you can't just be a really good lawyer and understand how to get cases approved, but you have to really understand how your business will evolve. When you first start out, especially I was 25 when I started my own practice, it was great because the times were good. Technology was expanding. People, you know, were hiring H-1Bs and other forms of immigration cases, you know, left and right. But then as things contracted, it was really important for me to understand how to make sure I had a long-standing business that had good fundamentals. And that book was extremely helpful to me.
And the E-Myth is also known as the entrepreneurial myth. It comes from the premise that, you know, most new businesses are not really started by entrepreneurs, but by technicians. That's people who do good work say, hey, I can make a business out of doing this work. And that's where lawyers fall in. Lawyers come out of law school, they come out of law firms, and they say, you know, I'm a pretty good lawyer. I'm going to start a law firm, and I'm going to run that firm, even though there's not a lot of business background for those individuals. And it's oftentimes a trial and error or following what somebody else does without really stopping and looking at this approach that, you know, really you're wearing three hats. And I think, Davis, that's what you're talking about. You're wearing the hat of the lawyer because you've got to be a lawyer, but you also have to be a manager, somebody who's, you know, looking at the books and making sure that the work is getting done properly and organizing things, but also from the standpoint of the entrepreneur, the person who's, you know, bringing in the business, who's got the vision of what the business is going to be, and also, is in charge of taking the risk.
And Reid, I think the e-myth is important for another reason. And by the way, I probably read it at the turn of the century or earlier. And its philosophy is that you should craft your business, set up its structure in a way that you could sell it as a franchise, even if that is not your intention. And in the case of lawyers, even though selling a law practice is not the easiest thing in the world to do. And why is that important? That is important because if you have enough internal systems and structures, tools and technology, you can push the work down to the level of the least expensive, least experienced employee to get as much of the work done at a competent level and replicate it so that your processes and procedures are essentially training manuals and career development pathways for people you hire in the future.
And Angelo, I couldn't agree more. That's the biggest thing that I've taken away from the book, which has been out for many years, but is still, you can still find it on online bookstores and other places because it's kind of the Bible for this kind of thing. That if you develop those systems and procedures from the mindset that, you know, I'm creating this business to franchise it, it gives you a better vision, a clarity of, okay, that's why these processes like your communications process, how is your phone answered, your time and billing process or your workflow processes, your calendaring, all those different processes that you have in your firm, then have a format. As you say, they're written down and become a training manual. You're not always the one doing the work. You can hire people to do that work within your practice.
You mentioned other books. Two that I would like to point out that I've found to be quite helpful. One is called Million Dollar Consulting by a gentleman named Alan Weiss, W-E-I-S-S, and the other is Relationship Economics, which is by a fellow named David Noor, N-O-U-R. And the first book is actually quite relevant to the practice of immigration law because this author scorns the hourly rate and says it's just a way to create an improper value mechanism, and that the flat fee, if properly structured, can be far more successful. And since flat fees are quite common in immigration, it would apply to what we do in our field. The second, relationship economics, is how you cultivate relationships. It's way beyond networking, way beyond social media. It's about recognizing that you can give value and you can receive value in a reciprocal way by building more and more intricate connections among your relationships.
And I will say that, to me, that second book speaks of marketing efficiency. Right. If you can build these relationships, it's really you're not spending more time marketing. You're targeting your referral sources and other things so that it's actually more efficient use of your time. Angelo, I know your description of those is going to get people on this podcast to want to rewind if they can. And so tell us the titles of those books again.
Sure, and I'm happy to send you an email so that they can have links to them. The first is by Alan Weiss, W-E-I-S-S, and it's called Million Dollar Consulting. He has written a number of books, and he actually has seminars around the country all the time at varying pricing arrangements. The second book is Relationship Economics by David Noor, N-O-U-R. And David speaks as well around the country on the subject.
Wonderful. So I think we all have agreed that while there are, and we'll talk more about this as we go, but having systems and processes that are clear, that are simple, that are orderly, and that are written down, right? I mean, that you've got, you know, I know some people, they call it their policy and procedures manual. Some people call it their firm cookbook. You guys might have a much more sophisticated version of them in your firms, but it's got to be written down. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Because if it's not written down, people will remember the conversation differently, and then the output will vary. And you want, from the client's perspective, to develop a brand where they know what the experience will be like and they receive it consistently.
Yeah, I think it also goes to making sure that they align with your culture and your organization of your firm's values. If you have a bunch of policies that don't make sense with some basic principles that guide your firm, then you're going to have a lot of confusion in the policies as to how they work together. So we, at my original firm, had three basic core values, which were integrity, inspiration, and innovation. And all of our policies and all of our reviews and all of our metrics were geared around those three basic concepts. And it made it really easy to follow policy. One of my early efforts to develop policy and metrics failed, and I talked to someone who's an advisor to me, and he says, well, you have the wrong policies. You aren't tracking the right things, and people don't understand how it relates to how you want to run your business. For example, on the innovation side, you know, making every case go faster, making every case more simple. And that started developing into our process and procedures around templates and the difference between templates and samples. And that's a really simple one. You know, a template is generic. It doesn't have any specific names. It doesn't have any specific case types. In some cases, you know, it could just be like your receipt letter, for example. But if you're constantly rereading or recreating that, you're wasting time. A sample, though, which is great to have a sample library, just is chock full of problems because those things could become stagnant or they could be used inappropriately. So that's for further down in this discussion, but you know, that's a summary of how we started this process of developing these processes.
And let me mention something that I thought was a little bit hokey, but I've come to realize is actually essential to the development of a culture within an organization, and that is that you develop a mission statement, a vision, and you engage in strategic planning with periodic retreats. If you don't invest in your team, the team won't feel that collegiality, that glue that keeps them together with a shared spirit. And the same goes for recruiting and interviewing people. You have to make sure that they're going to buy into that strategy and that vision and mission. And if they don't, if it's just another 9-to-5 job, they're not for you.
I think you're absolutely right, gentlemen, in terms of saying it, you know, yeah, you once thought it was hokey, but now you see how it fits in, I think is a very nice takeaway and would agree with you. To the person out there who's saying, well, I've got systems and I think they're pretty good, but I haven't written them down or I haven't started, you know, do you each have a little advice to how you would get started and how you would, you know, keep people motivated? Because I'm sure they're also saying, hey, this is going to be a lot of work.
Well, I think it starts with keeping it simple. The most important processes are the ones that are going to be used the most in your firm. So if you do a lot of temporary visas or if you do a lot of removal cases, you focus in on what you do best and you look for those inefficiencies to improve upon. And once you find a good system, then you write it down and you train people on it. The other thing that you have to do is you have to evaluate people on it. If you put in a process and no one follows it and there's no accountability, then it's just going to be noise, and it's going to be a process that serves no purpose.
So you would have them sit down and kind of look at each of those processes that they have in the firm. You know, as I mentioned a little earlier, you know, their communications process, how are the telephone answered, what happens if people are in the office, not in the office, what are your email policies, then move on to each of the business functions of your practice, right? How the work comes in, how it gets done, how it, you know, gets billed, and going through the whole economic cycle of work, and just building from there. Is that how you would tackle this?
Yeah, and I assigned actually my legal assistants who were touching the process frequently the responsibility of mapping that out and explaining it to others. Every time we had a successful matter that was just went really well, we said, well, let's break that down on why that went well, and let's make sure that our other matters follow that line. A really good example is we recently took a look at how we do PERM applications, so labor certifications, and said, how do we get these below 4 months in terms of processing? Because there are a lot of things that we had out there that were taking longer than we wanted. And one of the things, and this is real simple, was saying, instead of leaving it to the client to fill out a questionnaire, which is so important that they put in their information, we just set an appointment out. Said, look, your appointment's in a week and a half. And your appointment will go a lot better if you fill out this questionnaire beforehand, rather than just saying we'll set up a time after the questionnaire is completed. And we found an immense difference in terms of people's preparation when they actually had that their own internal deadline, and that came from an assistant looking at the process.
Let me approach it. I agree with you completely, Davis, but let me approach this from a slightly different way. And I think there are two general strategies, both of which work quite well. We talk about mapping processes, and one thing about a map is that it's a visual depiction of something. And when I had my own firm and repeatedly in my current firm, we develop business processes that are visual in nature. And that can be just going into a conference room and having a number of charts that can stick to a window or a wall and identifying in a kind of flow, or as some people call it, a decision tree, the life cycle of a particular case type. And as for an example, in my own firm, I had developed a process flow for the H-1B. And I had also, I have participated in the refinement of a process flow that had been developed in my current firm before I joined. And in each instance, you can do it by identifying the current state. What do we do now? And put it up on the wall, and then use Visio, which is a product that's in the Microsoft suite of products that's allowing you to graphically depict how a process works. And one of the interesting things that we discovered when we did what is the current state is how much happened within the attorney's mind or the paralegal's mind that had been never spelled out. Is this a case that will involve a credentials evaluation, or was the degree gained in the U.S.? Is this a case where a work experience evaluation will be required? Is this one of an evolving occupation where examples of industries requiring certain educational backgrounds is necessary? And zip, 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 we've already got several different legs of the process outlined. And if there is a credentials evaluation or work experience evaluation, then you create a process for that. Once you've done that, you then spend another day, because by the time you're done, it's a tiresome process. You spend another day saying, let's take the current state, and how can we streamline this? How can we eliminate unnecessary steps? How can we move them in time so they happen earlier or later and make it more advantageous? And just as with Davis's example of setting an appointment and requiring the questionnaire to be answered, or urging that the questionnaire be answered before the perm call with the client, that's how you do this. And it may sound laborious, it may sound boring, because you want to move ahead to the next case and the next client consultation, or get home early. The fact is, this is really a time saver.
And it's time for one of my favorite quotes from a professional services guru, and he says, your billable time determines your income, but your non-billable time determines your future. And by stopping and working on your business. You're investing in your future. You may not get home early. You may not make more money that day, but it's going to pay off down the road, you know, and often very quickly. So I think that's a that's an excellent example, Angelo. Let's look at, you know, if you've got systems in place today or you're developing, you know, more of your business processes and systems, you've got to look at, you got to measure yourself and say, how well are we doing on this? And so that brings up the issue of key performance indicators. You know, these are business metrics that can help an organization evaluate its performance. All right, so a lot of times in the practice of law, you know, some of the key, you know, metrics or the KPIs that people are using are revenue billed per month or total new clients per month or even what are our total monthly expenses. Those are indicators of your business. But there are many others that people can use, especially in looking at efficiency. You gentlemen have any that you particularly think are important in immigration firms today? What would you say to firms, big or small, what should they be watching for making sure that they're either maximizing their efficiency or giving them a tool that can improve their efficiency? Either of you, gentlemen?
I was waiting for Angelo, but
okay.
I could go ahead. Sorry. Angel, do you have some thoughts before I jump
well,
in?
Well, I can offer some thoughts. Thank you, Davis. I was waiting for you. But in this instance, I think that since we rise or fall as immigration lawyers, mostly in a flat fee environment, we don't have a good way to measure productivity. If we record hours, that may be some, whether we bill hours or not, bill on an hourly basis or not is irrelevant. That may be a way to measure productivity, but it has its flaws. And what I like and what we're moving toward is the concept of productivity by output. And that can involve, for example, first of all, a comparative examination of the difficulty of a case so that a paralegal that focuses on doing employment-based cases that are exempt from labor certification, extraordinary ability, outstanding professor or scholar, the national interest waiver or the O-1, they're not going to be able to do as many cases as the paralegal that does routine employment authorization document submissions, and that has to be taken into account. So you give a complexity factor, and that turns into a common currency, which you can call case values. And so you basically set a case value on each type of transaction or project that can be performed in your portfolio of services you provide to clients. I think that then measures in an objective way the productivity of an individual, and it allows comparisons across groups of people. The other thing that I've heard one lawyer do is they develop a quality control productivity measurement that deals with the distinction between harmless errors and egregious errors. And a harmless error may be, you know, a failure to capitalize a letter, or it may be the omission of a carbon copy to a particular person. An egregious error may be sending it to the wrong place or including the wrong amount of a filing fee where there are adverse consequences, and they track the number of those situations as well. And when it comes time for performance appraisal, you've got objective measurement criteria by which to show people how they rate within the organization in terms of their productivity and in terms of their quality. Davis, what do you do?
Oh, well, it depended on the organization I was in. In my own firm, we tracked something that's very similar to what Angelo mentioned, which was client satisfaction, anything that was above and beyond what a normal paralegal or attorney would do. And that would go into sort of a subjective bucket of compensation. Then we had their pure productivity in terms of dollars, and we took a look at that, and that went into another bucket for evaluation. We never billed hourly at my old firm. Now, at a bigger firm, and I've been at two national firms now, including the one I'm at now, we have similar buckets, but we track them through time. But also we do translations of flat fee work into time because, you know, the people who do flat fees at my current firm are about 3% of the total firm's revenue. So we have to honor the existing financial system, but at the same time translate what we do into a way that makes sense. There are a couple of things I wanted to mention about KPIs, which is first, you have to have consistency in terms of how people are entering in the data, and you have to close those books every month. And I think a lot of solo practitioners or small practitioners get really lazy about when they close their books, when they're doing their billing, when they're issuing their billing. So you can't really get a gauge for what's properly a month-by-month analysis year over year. The other thing about KPIs that I always worry about is making sure that people understand there's seasonality to a business. You know, there's vacation schedules, holiday schedules, but then we walk right back into the H-1B quota again. So there's a certain seasonality that you have to watch out for. And if you have year-over-year metrics, you'll actually be able to see leading versus lagging indicators. When you get paid is a lagging indicator because you've done the billing, you've done the work. But the problems that may keep you from getting paid or that you're seeing a drop in work don't appear if you don't track certain leading indicators, such as marketing activity. You know, how many meetings are you going to? How many referrals are you getting? How many referrals are you closing? And we used to use a point system by saying every time you give out a card, you get a point. Every time you have a lunch, it's 10 points. Every time you do a in-person pitch meeting, it's 50 points. We use that as a way of just tracking to make sure that leading indicators are showing that we're going to continue to have business. And what I always told my team is that getting the work done and getting it approved is not the metric of success. The metric of success is whether you get referred, because that's really what's going to keep your business sustainable. If the client is so happy with what you do that they continue to give your name out and refer you out, then you know you've done a good job.
I'm a little skeptical about client referrals in the sense that you have to distinguish between individuals and large corporations. I found that individuals are very happy to brag about their lawyers to friends and family, whereas corporations sometimes are concerned that if you introduce other large corporations to the attorney or law firm, they may lose their ability to serve you with the responsiveness that you want. So I don't know that I would necessarily measure the number of referrals, but I do think that client satisfaction measured at the closing of each case or on a periodic basis through surveys of both the HR or recruiting or C-suite individuals, as well as the foreign nationals who receive the immigration benefits, can be extremely helpful, especially year over year, as you suggest. One thing I would mention as well, you Davis, had said that Good to Great was a book that you read. I read it as well and found it to be outstanding. And it the philosophy of the book is what distinguishes a leading organization from one that's in the rest of the pack. And one of the points that was made was actually this: you have to have your critical key performance indicators measured, and preferably you will do that measuring on a dashboard, so that you don't have to kill yourself to extract the information, and that it's available regularly and relatively easily. And I think those are important as well.
And for anyone who's looking for the book, it's by Jim Collins.
Yeah. And written a few years ago as well, but again, a classic business book. And I wanted to get to the client satisfaction point for a moment and say that's really what drives your systems. So you've got to be measuring that from clients, doing the online surveys. They're much easier to do today, you know, using SurveyMonkey or some of the other products out there. If you're in a larger firm, doing some having somebody do interviews with clients, tracking that satisfaction, tracking repeat clients, so that when they come back, you're saying, ah, they're back again. And it's the information that they're giving you, right? They're saying, well, I didn't get a phone calls enough. I didn't, you know, I wasn't kept in the loop. Okay, now that's going to help us say, what do we need to do to change our processes to make sure that the clients feel like they're getting enough communication? And so you're going to use those that client satisfaction is really your end goal. But then you use the KPIs to see if you're getting closer to those goals. Gentlemen, we talked about it. We know that immigration law is mostly done on a flat fee, but that lawyers are reluctant to track their time. Do you believe that it's important from a business perspective, not necessarily from a time and billing perspective, but from a business perspective, so you can track some of your metrics, that people track their time and which clients it's going to and the kind of work that they were doing?
That's a very controversial subject. And I know forceful, persuasive attorneys on both sides of it. When I had my own firm, I tracked time, whether or not it was going to be billed. We tracked time at my current firm, whether or not it was going to be billed. And yet, there's an investment of time to track it, because there's the recording of time required. I do not track, for example, marketing efforts. Because I think, as they say in Glengarry Glen Ross, ABC, always be closing. Well, it's sort of ABM, always be marketing, and then always be closing. So I don't really track that other than marketing expenditures. We obviously can't do everything we want, and we have to prioritize the quality of it. I think you can track referral sources, and that's a great way to see whether you're gaining traction with particular communities of stakeholders or particular clients or particular service providers in allied professions. But I would say that I'm of the view that as long as we live in an environment where most of our competitors in the same industry are not tracking billable hours other than those that are billed on an hourly basis, that we need to stay abreast of that competition, and we have to develop alternative measurements of the effective use of time.
Yeah, it's funny because I dreaded the idea of tracking time at my old firm, but I also found that there was some inconsistency with how hard people worked. There are some values to tracking time, especially certain activities that are administrative in nature, because I see people frequently really struggle with the admin, but I have no idea of where their struggles are. I've also seen some valuable information in tracking hourly billing, but on flat fee matters, especially when I see an attorney struggling. For example, their cases are just taking too long. In labor certs or in I-140s in particular, you can see when they're just taking too long in drafting, or a paralegal is taking too long in drafting. In addition, one of the things that we all have to manage is paralegal overtime. You know, they're not salaried employees, at least in Washington State. We can't get away with that, and I think most of the country. So tracking someone's hourly metrics in terms of even flat fee matters sometimes helps us. One thing that we do as a leading indicator of whether people are successful or not is that every Monday we ask all the paralegals to say what their capacity is. And then we track how much overtime they do and how much revenue they generate. And if I see someone who's constantly saying they are 100% capacity, but their hours are tracking low and their revenue is tracking low, but their overtime is high, then I have a problem. And I think that's one of the really important things that we all have to manage, is how well we use our paralegal resources in particular.
I agree with that, and I think it's measuring things, even if it's not as exact for hourly billing purposes, but you're using it for business purposes, just to have paralegals, track the number of hours they're spending on client matters. And if you've got a problem paralegal, is to sort of ask them to break out, okay, how much time did you spend today on, working on this part of the matter and this part of the matter, so you can try to see if there's a training issue or if there's just a productivity problem. There could be a range of things, but that even for a little while, tracking it for a little while helps you figure out what your problem is and better manage that person who's generating income for your firm.
Yeah, but that is controversial, as Angela says.
Yep.
It can really upset people.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to talk about was marketing efficiency, and you gentlemen can jump in if you want, and that is, have people in your firm paying attention to new clients, things like new client inquiries or inquiries from potential clients, how many new phone consults if you do those, how many new office consults did you have this month, how many new case files were open, so that you're kind of looking at that sales, the end of your marketing funnel, and saying, well, how many people are actually, coming into our office, and how many, who were they referred by, so that you can see if your marketing efforts are really efficient. Do you think that works, or is it not worth tracking that type of thing?
Well, I would start at an earlier point, and I would say, what is your branding strategy? What forms of outreach will you make? And then start measuring your closings, your sales. In terms of another well-known law practice management guru, Jay Foonberg, there is the question of everyone is not a rainmaker. Not everyone can walk through an airport and attract clients. Some people are going to have a different set of skills, whether it's team-based efforts at marketing or merely putting a smile on their face when a new client or a consult comes in. And, I put in a sign. The person didn't want to use it, but I had a sign that for the receptionist that said manager of first impressions. There are all kinds of ways of doing it, and Jay Foonberg talks about mist making as well as rain making. And we can talk about that strategy, and we could probably dedicate the whole hour to the balance between relationship building and social media and developing mentions in the press and other things of that sort. But I guess when you get into it, you have to decide on the question of, are you trying to be the one-stop shop for everything immigration, or do you have pronounced niches that you want to focus upon? And does your marketing effort produce more inquiries than you wish to take, perhaps because qualified buyers do not call as often as you'd like? And you have to have a way to refer out or weed out cases that you don't handle or clients you don't seem to have a chemistry with. And so I find that one of the best ways of doing that is to establish a consultation fee. And it used to be that I was a lone ranger doing that, but I've seen a trend in the bar of not being willing to give away time, because there are quite a few window shoppers who want to learn by drilling down in a consultation with a lawyer, and if the lawyer doesn't value his or her time, certainly the prospective client will not value it. And so, do you have a procedure around consultations? Can you sign up online and book a time slot and pay online and answer a questionnaire online? Or do you have to be screened to see whether you even want to spend time, I almost said waste time, talking with some people? And who does the screening? Can a paralegal do the screening? Is that a turnoff to sophisticated clients who want to talk to a lawyer? Is it something that saves headaches later if a case that turns out to be a turkey for whatever reason is accepted because an inexperienced person did the first consult? There are a lot of issues that go into that, and each law firm is going to find its own way. But these are some of the questions. I find that charging a consultation fee that's only for the consult, no follow-up work whatever, doing it with an engagement agreement, running a conflicts check, if you can systematize that and make it a quick process, we'll weed out folks that do not fit your model of service delivery or your repertoire of cases. And it also has the effect of reminding people that your time is worth something and that they should be expected to pay legal fees, which is, as Abraham Lincoln said, our stock in trade is our time.
Yep. Thank you for that. We're going to move along in our process and get to some of the more common process improvement tools. What are some of the, you know, products, services, ideas that are out there to make your office more efficient? I'm going to tackle the first one and say training your staff on the existing software that's there, making sure that they've had they're up to date with that will help drive efficiency, because most of us don't know that much about each of the software programs we have on our computer. So taking training, there's a lot of video training today. There's free training, low-cost training. You know, we use a lot of Microsoft Word. We use a lot of the other, you know, and we'll talk about immigration case management and other things, but have we really been trained? That, to me, is the first step with anybody looking to improve their business processes. What about software? Let's talk about software that you have used or may use in terms of the, you know, let's start with immigration case management software. You know, we're all familiar with the products, you know, the LawLogix, the INS Zooms, the Blue Dot, Lolly Law, you know, that genre of does that help a firm if you establish one of those products in your firm and train your staff on those?
Let us not forget Immigration Tracker, and I think that they do help. They have become increasingly essential because they are not merely a case management tool, but they're a forms production tool. They're a docketing system, and so they bring structure to the relationship with the client, and particularly if you have clients that do not resist the completion of forms online, you have reduced your cost of inputting data significantly. Obviously, it needs to be reviewed, but nevertheless, the client certainly knows how to spell their last name better than your staff might. And so errors are reduced as a result. So I would say they all perform essentially the same function. They have different bells and whistles. They have different abilities to be customized to your particular needs, some with additional consulting fees, some with the capability of doing it oneself. But these are essential. And the other value is that as forms change, which they repeatedly do, they bear the burden of making sure the latest form is used and not your own group, because if you go to that sample file that Davis mentioned, that may have the old form, and it may not be perceived that that is out of date and that not all the questions that need to be asked are asked on the old form.
Yep.
The government keeps trying to, you know, pin the petitioner or the beneficiary or the applicant down with greater degrees of specificity when the older forms didn't ask so much.
Yep. Davis?
On the immigration software, I mean, you're dealing with a lot of products that are off the shelf built for any kind of immigration law firm. So you have to be really careful about how you're customizing that product. I know that, you know, I have multiple offices that do immigration. one of my first weeks here, I accidentally changed a template that affected another office. So you have to be really careful about that. But if you use your software carefully, and I think the immigration software and the Office product suite are the things that you have to become experts in, you can really eliminate a lot of time. Here are a couple of tips that I would use. First of all, really having electronic-based templates that have drop-down menus and that could be integrated with your forms program. That's probably your first step. Because if you go back 10 years ago, trying to get a client to fill out a questionnaire that wasn't just on Word or on paper was a lot harder than it is today. A lot of clients are very willing to open that account on whatever software you're using so that they could have their own visibility to their cases. And that transparency has a lot of value, especially in the world of technology clients. The other thing that I think people really need to be using is the tickling software or their calendaring software so that next year when you have your H-1B quota, the cases that didn't get approved, you can go ahead and possibly initiate those cases again without having to go through the process of saying, okay, what cases were denied last year or rejected because of the quota. They're sitting there right there for you. And every 3 years, potentially, you have a renewal to do. Or you're tracking down people's expiration dates on, their priority dates. The article that Reed, you and I wrote in 2009 actually had a nice little template for how to track that information. It's really figuring out how to automate some of the things that we have to do and not reinvent the wheel all the time.
And
I think
by
those
the
are the
way,
easiest
that,
places.
That article is part of the podcast. You can download it as part of that or get it on AILA.org. It's best practices in practice management. And Davis, just to follow up, immigration case management, are you using the calendaring function on there, the tickler calendaring function, or are you using Outlook or Google Calendar, whether you're using one of those suites?
Yeah, we use LawLogix now, and mm-hmm. we use their tickling software.
Okay.
The other thing that we customize, the three things that we use on LawLogix the most that help other than just basic forms production is the Word integrator. So a client pops something into Word, we create the fields, and it auto-populates basic letters for receipts, approvals, and for support documentation. It always needs to be checked over, though, but it's a good starting place. Then we use the expiration dates quite extensively, and then we also customize the intake forms. So you could say for this kind of process, we only want these parts of the person's background. One area that I think is really interesting, though, is how the immigration law has changed how we use the software. For example, we no longer can simply assume that there's just an H-4, but now we have to think about H-4 EADs, whether someone had an I-140 before and there's an H-4 EAD. It's just one of those areas that if you have a good system in place that's tracking the data, then it makes the efficiency in getting those new cases under your belt much, much more effective.
And you're gathering that data from your immigration case management system, LawLogix?
Yes, and most of the products do similar things. It's just the user has to be expert enough to find it and use it.
Right, and that gets to the training, and it's just not stopping at the first level of I understand how to get this petition or application done. I'm done learning the product. You have to keep digging deeper and invest some time in that to bring the efficiencies back out. Go ahead. Go ahead, Angelo. Sorry.
Talk about applications that are out there. One of the ones that we found to be very helpful, but again, you have to invest in customizing it, is HotDocs, or under the general category of document assembly software. We see a great number of variables in the immigration world when we're processing cases. The government will indicate on its website one day, no longer send these documents to the Texas Service Center, now send it to the newly established, I'm making this up, Minneapolis Service Center. The filing fee, by the way, has changed, and you need now to cut two checks instead of one, and we will give you the option of paying by credit card. Or you have a single applicant or petitioner, or you have a number of family members, spouse of differing genders, or the same gender, and you have children. And when you write a letter in English, you have to be careful about pronouns and adjectives that change depending upon the number of subjects or individuals. And therefore, document assembly software basically begins with the proposition, much like the DS-160 non-immigrant visa application, that it's an all-purpose system where the questions will change depending on the answers given at the initial phases of the screen view. And once you are done with that, you say, you know, create the letter, and you've got a letter that can be customized to a variety of different case types, visa categories, procedures and strategies. And when the government changes the approach again, you don't have to remember that every one of your samples is out of date, and you've got to alert people, and they have to remember. Instead, it's done at a central location, and then it radiates from the center core to all of the applications where it fits. And so I think that document assembly software is extremely important, and I've seen law firms being in various stages of sophistication in terms of embracing that.
Yep, and it's growing because we don't need to be spending time drafting documents. It's easier to use one of these tools, having drafted a model, and then, as Davis was mentioning earlier, making sure you go back and you check it, but it can be done easier. And let me just give you a couple in the market today, because they're a lot easier and actually a little bit cheaper than they were even a few years ago. So Angela mentioned Hot Docs. I also want to mention the Form tool, which is free, the Form tool. And they've got a version of the Form Tool Pro that's a one-time fee. That same company does a little more sophisticated version called Doxera, D-O-X-S-E-R-A. And then the final product is Pythagoras, spelled like the Pythagoras theorem. These products are aimed at the lawyer market, especially the smaller market, although Doxera is for larger businesses too. And I really do, as Angelo just gave a wonderful examples, this is something that you can add on to your practice to help you with those documents and letters that aren't in your immigration case management file.
Let me mention one other application that I've recently been introduced to and find it extremely powerful, and that's a project management solution called Smartsheet. And Smartsheet integrates with your email system. So if you use Outlook or Gmail, it will integrate with that. It allows you to create teams and assign projects. It does calendar deadlines. It can really help to increase the efficiency when you deal with the work as a matter of project management and not merely the completion of a single case. It allows you to focus on corporate client relationships or repeat referral sources, and it really can be a flexible tool even for your personal to-do list.
Davis, are you using project management software as Angela's described?
Well, it's interesting. I've used it in the past, and we actually have a project management expert within a large firm, this firm, and he'll be coming up here to take a look at where we can use the application for us. And a lot of it has to do with making sure that the time we spend on a matter is being tracked to budget so that we can see what our efficiencies are, and then where there are inefficiencies, trying to rid ourselves of those inefficiencies.
And I would say, document assembly is very practical, useful today, but certainly project management is clearly growing in use across firms, mostly in medium to larger size firms. but there's value there for solo firms. And a couple of the common products, you know, Smartsheet, as Angelo said, but there's also Trello, Asana, A-S-A-N-A, and Basecamp. Basecamp probably being the more well-known of those, although a little more expensive. But those are some of the tools that help build in, help you with the efficiencies that are going on. You know, we're starting to run out of time a little bit, so I want to turn to sort of the thinking from the client's perspective about you know, building inefficiencies. You don't want to shortchange the client in any of this process. What do clients need today? And look at big versus small clients too, right? You've got clients who maybe need, you know, 100 or more H-1Bs, you know, versus a smaller firm that might be doing, a small company where you might be doing just five. What are clients looking for today, and how would you add them into this mix of gaining efficiencies?
Well, I'm happy to jump in. I would say that you can divide the world, I think relatively fairly, between clients that have a smaller number and clients that have a larger population of foreign nationals. As for the smaller client, I have found that unfortunately they don't have the resources to dedicate the same person on an ongoing basis to perform immigration functions, and those are very important functions, dealing with the vetting of information and documentation provided to the government because it's submitted under penalty of perjury. And they need more hand-holding. They need access to more explanations of what is required and how to access the information, how to confirm its accuracy. Whereas a large client may have already developed a number of systems, but may be facing a different pressure. I have seen, for example, a pressure to reduce headcount in large organizations, and a pressure to have secondments of people from the law firm to be either on the ground or in a virtual relationship with the foreign national population and the managers in an organization to deal with the answering of questions. And that's apparently acceptable that you can have an external vendor provide that, and it's not a headcount number that affects the budget in the same way. Another thing that can be done is gaining access to the HRIS system that the company uses. I know one client that was just drowning in email communications and delays associated with case initiation, and they decided that they would define parameters as to what would be trigger events that would ordinarily require some immigration analysis or immigration task, whether that be a documenting of a fact or the submission of a new case or the posting of an LCA. They did that in a way that the lawyer could harvest the information, reduce the number of emails involved and the delay involved in case initiation, and as long as the lawyer did it within the scope of the parameters that were defined in advance, the lawyer would get paid. Now, that's really at the cutting edge, but that shows you how to be embedded within your client through secondments and through that sort of situation where there's an cost for them to move, where they have a stickier relationship with you. One of the challenges is to serve a client both in a high-level strategic way to offer advice and guidance and solve complex problems. Another, though, is to provide the more routine work that is done on a repetitive basis. I don't want to use the word commodity because I don't think of it as a commodity since human beings are involved, but there is a certain routine element to some quantity of cases. So those are some things that can be thought of. But the other part of it is just sitting down and engaging with what is called voice of the client exercises, actually trying to deliver the service that the client wants and is willing to pay for, and eliminate the service that the lawyer thinks the client wants but doesn't really value. I would encourage people to read a book called Blue Ocean Strategy, and I can't remember the name of the authors, but it sets forth the phenomenon of developing opportunity to perform your business within the blue ocean, where you do not have competitors as you would have in the red ocean, where there are many other fish swimming about looking for opportunities to feed themselves. And you do that, just as, say, some of the discount airlines have done, by eliminating frills that the clients don't want and adding things that the clients consider essential. They may want to have free movies and Wi-Fi more than, the dinners that are served. I don't know. The airline industry is different. They may want to have a circus experience that looks more like Cirque du Soleil than to have a Ringling Brothers circus, and I cast no aspersions on either of those organizations. The point is, we think we know, but we don't necessarily know what's the main factor that moves the client, that drives its business. So we should find that out.
Yeah, I think as the client gets bigger and more institutional, the more savvy we have to be to listen to what they really want. I have one client who doesn't care what the bill is, but they have an extremely high compliance requirement. And obeying both the letter and the spirit of the law is really important for them. Whereas I have other clients who have internal experts who say, look, we'll take part of your job off your hands, but we want to see a reflective cut in billing and integration with our software system. I think that one of the really nice comments that was made by an internal immigration buyer was at the Maui mid-year conference, which I think is the last time I saw Reed, where one of the internal general counsel said, all of you are smart, and all of you have reasonable billing, and all of you are reasonably responsive. So what's the difference between any of you? And that's the thing that will separate you, is finding out how you can exceed those baseline expectations, where a lot of people just struggle to meet those baseline expectations. The really great lawyers are the ones who are going to figure out how to be something special to their clients. And that really does require face-to-face, understanding their voice, as Angela says, and spending time with them.
Thank you. We are just about out of time, but I want you guys to just, and we'll start with you, Davis, just a couple of quick practical tips, takeaways, something that people can, use in the context of what we've talked about today to, improve their efficiency in the practice of immigration law.
Well, so I started my practice when I was 25, and somehow we hit $1 million in revenue in 6 years. And what we realized was you can't do it all yourself. You have to manage your internal and external resources. And then you have to learn how to scale your business accordingly. So you can make an investment in staff and all these processes and procedures, but it may be too early to do so. So just make sure you're looking at your business and building the processes and procedures to your scale and your plan.
Wonderful. Angelo.
I know this is a little bit controversial, and it requires a sensitivity to ethical requirements and client notice and consent, but I think it's extremely valuable to develop an external service provider to support the creation of the forms and the documentation needed to support the docketing required and to work while the law firm is closed. I know of a number of firms, my own included, that does this, and I've been involved in this for the LPO industry for a long time. And some may sneer, some may think it's unpatriotic, but we have to remember that we're dealing with new competitors, both at the low end and the high end of the price scale, and lawyers are seen, as the suggestion was just made, as something of a commodity, and you have to have a brand and differentiate yourself. I would also suggest that you keep an eye on alternate sources of services, and that you develop a plan to be the quarterback in putting together a project that may have multiple players. Just like a movie is made with a different team every time, you have to be able to do that. And I think there's one other point that I would make, and that is you should read a book by Richard Susskind called Tomorrow's Lawyers, which will tell you why the law practice business is changing and why you need to adapt to those changes. Lastly, I believe in the concept of a mastermind group, brain trusts, kitchen cabinets, but cultivate small groups of colleagues, whether they're in your same city and you can see them more frequently, or whether they're around the country and you may only meet them at ALA meetings or specially arranged meetings. But you need to know what's going on the ground, and you can't have every experience with every government agency. You need to be able to share intelligence. You need to be able to share tips and strategies. You need someone on whose shoulder you can cry when you get that outrageous denial, or who gives you the inspiration to find a solution to a problem that has been perplexing you. I formed something a while back called the Alliance of Business Immigration Lawyers for that very reason, but anybody can do this. You just have to find like-minded lawyers or owners of law practices that will have that similar mindset to share, even though we are competitors.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you for being faculty for this podcast today and sharing insights into maximizing efficiency in the practice of law. And I hope everyone that's listening is taking notes and will take away some good things, because both Davis and Angelo have are living this, and I think as we said at the beginning, this is the direction lawyers have to go today in maximizing efficiency in the practice of law. So with that, we'll hand it back over to Rebecca to give us our CLE code.
Thank you. For those of you who will be seeking CLE credit for your participation in this podcast, please make note of the following four-digit attendance verification code. The four-digit code is 3968. Again, the code is 3968. Please visit ALA's Web CLE Center at www.alawebcle.org to record your CLE credit. Thank you very much to all of our speakers for sharing their knowledge and expertise, and to you for joining us today. That concludes our podcast.